Okay, well, as you mentioned, I am trained as an ophthalmologist, and one of the things I did as an ophthalmologist was the majority of the research for the laser that's used in LASIK surgery for the company called Missex. And I had a lot of fun doing that research, but one of the things we didn't know at the time was that the laser would not kill viruses. And so as the laser would remove tissue and cells from the front of the cornea, it also released viruses which went through my mask and into my nose and thus into my brain, and I developed encephalitis. In addition, it affected my spleen, and I developed a bleeding disorder. So basically what happened is that I developed excruciating fatigue, and got to where I could remember how to diagnose what was wrong with somebody, but I couldn't even remember how to write a prescription. In addition, I developed spastic movements, which doesn't work really well if you're operating inside somebody's eyeball. And for all those reasons, I had to quit working at the end of November in 1995. And so I went to the best doctors I could find, and all of them said, well, you have three viruses in your brain. We don't know what to do about it, so good luck. So the problem for me was that I could only read a newspaper and understand it for about 2 or 3 hours a day, and then like a light switch, it would turn off, and I couldn't understand it anymore. And so it became apparent to me that I had to figure out how to get myself well in those 2 or 3 hours a day in which I could think clearly enough to think about things. So one of the things that I thought about was that if I could figure out how to make one cell work, I could figure out how to make them all work. And so I bought a bunch of cellular biology books, which I hadn't read in 30 years or so, and began to read through them. Excuse me. So one of the things that jumped out off the pages for me for some reason was that each book would either have a sentence or even a page about the fact that cells are designed to run in a environment of a pH of 7.35 to 7.45. And I didn't really understand exactly what that meant. I remembered that pH was acid-base balance, but that's about all I could remember. So I began to look at pH and discovered that pH is simply the measurement of voltage in a solution. So if you think about voltage in a wire, like a copper wire that brings voltage to a light bulb, the light switch is either on or off. But in a solution like water, you have an option of it being an electron donor or an electron stealer. And so you use a sophisticated voltmeter that will measure the voltage of a solution and will tell you if it's an electron donor or an electron stealer. And then by convention, you convert that voltage measurement to a logarithmic scale that goes from 1 to 14. So basically a pH of 0 is a synonym for plus 400 millivolts of electron stealer, and a pH of 14 is a synonym of a voltage of minus 400 millivolts, minus meaning electron donor. So once I began to realize that pH was really just a measurement of voltage, then it began to make sense, because a pH of 7.35 is a synonym to minus 20 millivolts, and 7.45 is a synonym of minus 25 millivolts. So now it began to make sense. Cells have to have electrons or voltage in order to work. That made perfect sense to me. So people sometimes get confused, by the way, because if you put an electrode inside of a cell and outside of the cell and measure across the cell membrane, you'll get somewhere around minus 90 millivolts. But the environment or the pH of the extracellular fluid in which all the cells operate is that 7.35 to 7.45 or minus 20 to minus 25 millivolts. So the next order of business for me was to figure out, okay, how do I measure it? So I began to look for that answer and found that a Japanese chap named Nakatani had become the first person to use modern electronics to measure acupuncture meridians, and he published his work in 1951. A German named Reinhold Voll published his similar work the following year, 1952. So I simply got Dr. Nakatani's rather crude, by modern standards, instrumentation, and began to measure things and realized that my brain was running between 2 and 4 millivolts when it needed to be at 25 millivolts, and therefore I understood why it didn't work. So that's kind of the beginning of the story. Would you like me to continue, or you have some other questions for me?
Oh, I have plenty of questions, but I think it's important to continue with the story. There's more, I mean, even so some of the images, some pictures where you are incapacitated, pretty much sleeping, I believe it was 16 hours a day, and you have two dogs. And this is something very interesting because I've seen this happen before where the dogs go to areas of the body that are affected. In this case, it's the area of, or areas of your body that had less electrons, meaning your brain and your spleen, and you show a picture. Can you tell us more about that image?
Yeah, I had two Pomeranian dogs that were brothers, and one was named Tigger and one was named Pooh. And Tigger would always come and lay on my head, and Pooh would always come curl up next to my spleen. And so it became obvious to me that they knew where I was in trouble and were trying to help me with that. Once I got well, they quit doing that. So I found that fascinating.
Absolutely. And there are two pictures of you, one at 58 and one at 65. And you look so much younger, so much better at 65. So of you, it's so obvious the change that you went through. How long did it take before you get well 100%?
Well, it's a difficult thing. It was never like one day I was sick and the next day I was well. But when I began putting voltage in, it was about 6 weeks before I could tell that my brain was starting to function again and I could think more hours and more clearly and not have such overwhelming fatigue. But of course, as we'll talk in a little bit, the brain takes about 8 months or so to replace itself. And so it was, you know, that period of up to a year before I was really up and going again. So the next real piece of the puzzle that I began to recognize is the change in paradigm. The standard medical paradigm in this country is that when you get sick, particularly for chronic illnesses, we have to find some sort of a chemical that will eliminate the symptoms that you have. And if that doesn't work, we remove the offending part surgically. And if that doesn't work, we're out of bullets.
So you mask it or you eliminate it?
Yep. That's basically American medicine. You know, our Heavenly Father didn't build an organism that was going to require digitalis or toprol or penicillin or anything else. The body was designed in order to and knows how to heal itself, and foreign chemicals are not really part of that intended process, in my view. And so that paradigm actually doesn't work very well, and the data bears me out. The World Health Organization rates medical outcomes in the United States as 37th in the world as far as the adequacy of our medical treatment, which is just above Cuba. So that system that we use simply isn't working all that well. Now, it does work well for acute illness. You know, if I have a car wreck and I've got a bone sticking out the side of my leg, you know, find me plenty of drugs and a good anesthesiologist and a good orthopedic surgeon to put me back together. And American medicine does that quite well. But for acute or for chronic illnesses, our system, our paradigm just simply doesn't work well. So the paradigm that I have come to believe is that all chronic disease occurs when we lose the ability to make new cells that work. And let me explain that further. We get new cones in the macula of our eye every 2 to 3 days. The lining of our gut's replaced every 3 days. The skin that you're sitting in this moment is only 6 weeks old, and your liver is 8 weeks old, etc. So we're constantly wearing ourselves out and having to make new cells. Now, if we lose the ability to make new cells, then, of course, we can't keep ourselves repaired, and over time, whatever organs we're talking about begin to malfunction. And just simply get worse and worse over time. And so if you agree with me with that paradigm that chronic disease occurs when you lose the ability to make new cells at work, it leads us to the question, what does it take to make a new cell that works? Well, I mentioned that cells are designed to run at an environment of minus 20 to minus 25 millivolts, but to make a new cell, you need minus 50 millivolts. So one of the characteristics of chronic disease is that you have low voltage and you don't have the ability to make new cells. So if you think about my thumb as I sit here, I've got a perfectly good thumb, works fine, looks fine. Now I hit it with a hammer, and the hammer destroys a bunch of cells in my thumb. What normally happens in the way we're designed is that the thumb will automatically go to minus 50 millivolts. And at minus 50 millivolts, it causes the arterial capillaries to dilate. And the reason we're designed that way is that we have to have those capillaries dilate so that it can dump the necessary materials like amino acids and vitamins and minerals and fats and things you need to make a new cell. So when those arterial capillaries dilate, then the thumb is swollen, it has a pulsing pain, it's red, it's warm, and of course it makes you say bad words. So,
yeah, right.
So we get busy making new cells because we have all the requirements, and we make cells and replace those we smashed with a hammer. And now the thumb goes back to being a normal thumb, and we're perfectly happy. But in chronic disease, the scenario is different in that we don't have enough voltage and or we don't have enough raw materials to make new cells. And so the thumb drops down to below operating voltage. So let's say it's at minus 10 or minus 15 millivolts. And usually it hurts all the time because chronic pain is simply a symptom of low voltage. And so the thumb hurts, it's white, it doesn't work very well, it doesn't have much strength to it, etc. And no matter how many pills I take, no matter how much surgery you do on my thumb, nothing good happens. It doesn't get well until you have all the things that are necessary to make new cells. And again, to make new cells, you have to have minus 50 millivolts of electron donor of voltage. The outside of cells are made of fats called phospholipids. The inside of cells are made of amino acids. Then you have to have vitamins and minerals, and those are under the control of Fulvic, F-U-L-V-I-C. You have to have oxygen, which is controlled by both voltage and nitric oxide. And you have to have water. And the water inside the cell is a special water, H3O2. Not H2O, and you have to then be sure you don't have any sort of toxins hanging around that are going to destroy cells as fast as you make them. So if you're loaded with pesticides or mercury or whatever, then that's going to destroy cells and keep them from working. So So basically, chronic disease occurs when you lose the ability to make new cells that work.
And this book of yours, over 540 pages long, folks, and I have to tell you, it will be with me wherever I go because it opens so many doors. I thought I knew a lot after doing this show for a while now. I thought I knew a lot, but the electron donor, electron stealer, and some of the things you mentioned here are just life-saving. You know, our bodies are electric. Well, a lot of people don't know that. But right from the beginning, let me ask you this question, Dr. Jerry. Is standard medical practice dangerous?
Well, that's a tough question to answer. It depends, of course, on what it is that you're trying to do. There are certain situations in which the body is so threatened that you need standard medical things to buy you enough time to get the body to make new cells to repair itself. So, you know, if I've got meningitis and my temperature is 105 and I'm having seizures and whatever, you know, you want standard medical care to get that under control, to stop the seizures, to get the fever down, to in such critical situations, you would be best off to use aggressive antibiotics. So there are situations, as I mentioned, like a bone sticking out the side of my leg, there are situations in which standard medical care does quite well. And as I see patients in my clinic, sometimes I'll see somebody come in that has a blood pressure that's so high I can't afford the time it's going to take for the body to get back in balance so that it'll normalize. I really have to get it down so they don't have a stroke. You understand the difference?
Certainly, certainly.
Yeah, yeah. So you can't just write off standard medical practice as unnecessary and even wrong. But the point is that that's not the way the body was designed. And unless you're in a critical emergent situation, then getting the body to have the tools to repair itself by making new cells is a much better and more effective solution, in my experience, than giving people pharmaceuticals and sending them out the door. So I think both are necessary, and that's one of the reasons I practice what's called integrative medicine, so that I have the opportunity to deal with urgent situations if I have to buy me the time to fix things the way the body was designed to do it.
I like what you say about the hammer and the finger. If I hit myself with a hammer, I get inflammation, swelling. If I have a cold and I get a fever, why is it that we are used to countering the body's natural reactions? In other words, we put ice or anti-inflammation medicine, or we use fever-lowering drugs, or once again, ice. Why do we do that if the body's trying to heal itself?
Well, we humans don't like any sort of pain or misery, and we want some kind of instant fix that makes any symptoms go away. That often leaves residual. And a perfect example of that is that almost nobody dies from the flu. People die from the pneumonia that develops after you get the flu. And so what often happens is that people get the flu, and then they start taking drugs to lower their fever, and they take drugs to get rid of the pain and things they have in their muscles, and drugs to shut down the diarrhea, etc. And they'll start feeling better in a few days, and then a week later they crash with pneumonia because you've suppressed their immune system, and it's the pneumonia that kills people with the flu, not the flu itself. So, again, we have this desire not to have any time in which we feel bad, but that's really usually not the best approach. I think the Indians had an interesting way of dealing with things like that. So if you got sick and had a fever, they would build some sort of a house, depending on what tribe they were with, that was a sweat lodge, and they would build a fire in there to make it warmer and then wrap you up in blankets or animal skins or whatever to raise your temperature, because they knew that the bacteria and viruses did not do well when the body temperature was raised. And so by raising the temperature, that was their primary method of getting people well from infectious diseases. And we do just the opposite. We take Tylenol or aspirin or Motrin or something to lower the fever, which then allows the infectious things to multiply. It's said that if a virus enters your system and your temperature is normal, it cannot multiply. But if your temperature is low, then you'll make a million copies in a few minutes.
Now, what are the main mechanisms that control voltage in our bodies?
That's a great question. But before we go there, let me take you down one other road first, if I may.
Sure. Please, sure.
The scenario is that our body is running at minus 25 millivolts, but then as voltage begins to drop, several bad things happen. And you can know that all of these things are happening when you measure that voltage is low. First of all, at say minus 15 millivolts, we begin to feel tired all the time. But as voltage continues to drop, several bad things happen, one of which we've already mentioned, which is pain, chronic pain. But another one is a reduction in the availability of oxygen. The amount of oxygen that will dissolve in water is dictated by the voltage of the water. So if I take a glass of water and I put a tube in it and I start bubbling oxygen into that water, the amount that will dissolve is dictated by the voltage. So if I raise the voltage of the water, more oxygen goes into solution. But if I lower the voltage of the water, oxygen actually comes out of solution and goes away. Well, our cells are about 70% water, so as the voltage in the cell drops, then the oxygen begins to disappear. Well, there are several bad things that happen when oxygen begins to disappear. One of them is the efficiency of our metabolism. For all of the metabolism that goes on in the cell, voltage is required, and we have a rechargeable battery system inside the cell that provides that voltage. And when the battery is charged up, it's called ATP, and when it's discharged, it's called ADP. So our ADP, our ATP is constantly providing voltage so our cells can work, and then those batteries become discharged and obviously need to have a battery charger. So we have a battery charger inside our cells called the Krebs cycle. So the Krebs cycle likes to burn fat. So for every unit of fat you put into the Krebs cycle, if you have oxygen available, it creates enough electrons to charge up 38 of those ATP batteries. But if you don't have oxygen available, for every unit of fat you put in the battery charger, you only get enough electrons to charge up 2 of those ATP batteries. So when oxygen drops, the efficiency goes from 38 miles to the gallon to 2 miles to the gallon, so to speak. And so the whole process of trying to keep the cell working becomes very inefficient and puts great demands on the whole system. Well, remember that the thing that controls oxygen is our old friend voltage. So when voltage drops, oxygen drops. When oxygen drops, we go from 38 miles to the gallon to 2 miles to the gallon. Well, there's another bad thing that happens. Each of us contains maybe a trillion bugs. And those bugs are suppressed and asleep as long as oxygen's around. But as oxygen levels begin to drop, the bugs wake up. And when the bugs wake up, the first thing they want to do is have lunch. And of course, the first they're going to have you for lunch.
That's right.
Well, bugs don't have teeth, so they can't take a bite out of your cells. So rather, they put out digestive enzymes, which dissolve the cells so that the nutrients are available to the bugs. Well, think about strep bacteria that are having lunch on your tonsils. They're having a good old time. But how do you feel? Well, you have the world's worst sore throat. And those digestive enzymes that they put out to dissolve your tonsils get in your bloodstream, and they give you the world's worst headache. They give you a high fever. They make you have vomiting and diarrhea. And they can even go down and scar your heart valves and scar your knees and so forth. And so it's these digestive enzymes that these bugs put out that are really doing the damage to you. In addition to making you feel bad, they actually do damage, like scarring your heart valves. And this can happen with all different sorts of bugs. And so as voltage continues to drop and oxygen levels continue to drop, when voltage drops down to plus 30 millivolts is when you get cancer. So there is fairly convincing evidence that cancer is caused when cell wall deficient fungus damages the ATP or cellular voltage, and it's the lowered cellular voltage that allow the cells to become malignant and begin to form tumors. Perhaps this would be a reasonable time to even discuss some game-changing things that happened with that conversation about cancer.
Absolutely.
For certainly all of my career, until recently, it seemed that cancer occurred when genes in your cells mutated for some unknown reason, and it was the mutated genes that drove the cells to multiply and begin develop tumors. Well, that all changed last year. Well, actually, November of 2012. A researcher named Thomas Seyfried in Boston took cancerous cells and removed the cancerous nucleus with its mutated genes and replaced it with a normal nucleus with normal genes, assuming that the cell would then revert back to being normal. It did not. It remained cancerous. Then he did the opposite. He took normal cells, removed their nucleus, and inserted a cancerous nucleus with mutated genes, assuming the cell should then become malignant. It did not. It stayed normal. And then this was repeated at six other universities. And so it became apparent that it wasn't mutated genes that was driving the bus. And so the next thing they figured out was that all cancer cells have low levels of ATP, which is another way of saying low levels of voltage, and damaged mitochondria. And it's my conclusion, based on work of many others showing the role of fungus in cancer, that it's that when voltage drops to plus 30, and this cell wall deficient fungus shows up, it's their toxins that damage the mitochondria and therefore lower the ATP, and therefore you end up with the malignant cells. Well, the next thing that Seyfried did was to realize that all cells prefer to run on glucose, but they all have a backup fuel system where they can run on ketones. But what happens with when the in the cancerous cells is that they lose their ability to burn ketones for fuel and can only burn glucose. Well, that's terribly important, because what he did next was to take animals that had malignancies and put them on a diet that created ketones. And within a few days, the tumors simply disappeared because they had no fuel. And then he began to do it in humans and got similar results. Now, Seyfried himself recommends that people take what he calls a reduced ketogenic diet, which is sort of like small portions of an Atkins diet. I think that perhaps there might be a better way to do that, because Atkins diet is strong in protein and the body can convert proteins to glucose. So one of the things Seyfried found was that the cancer kill zone is when you drop the blood glucose to less than 65, and that the blood ketones is over 2. And so if you put somebody on just a water fast, the body will go out and convert your fat cells into ketones. And so what I see happening is that as people start the water fast, they're hungry after they miss the first meal and even more hungry after they miss the second meal. But by the third meal they miss, generally the hunger goes away. And then on about the third day or so, you get some brain fog because you're beginning to release quite a few toxins as you open up the fat cells. But that tends to go away in a day or two, and then people seem to get into that cancer kill zone somewhere around the fourth or fifth day of fasting.
Is that ketosis when you're in ketosis?
Yeah, it is ketosis because your blood ketones is 2.
Right.
Now, you don't get damage from ketones generally until you get somewhere up around 20 or greater. And so when you're in the 2 to 4 range, that's not an issue. The only people that tend to get into trouble trying to do this are type 1 diabetics, according to Seyfried, that type 2 diabetics do fine, but not type 1. One of the things that hasn't been addressed, because we don't have the data collected, is how effective is this? Is it cure 100% of people, 50% of people, 5% of people? We don't really know yet. And how long do you need to stay in the fasting state? I think that depends on how much total mass of tumor you have. For people that have a total mass the size of a grape, then if you kill all those cells, the liver and kidneys can deal with that fairly easily. If your total body tumor mass is the size of a basketball and you kill all of that fairly quickly, it would overwhelm the kidneys and liver. So I think you have to sometimes pulse it so that you do a little bit and kill a little bit and then wait a week and then do it again and so forth. But the point is that Seyfried's work has been evaluated by other cancer experts like Steven Strum. Dr. Strum has come out and publicly supported the quality of the research that Seyfried has done. So I think this is a real game changer as far as our understanding of what's going on with cancer. And you can read about Seyfried's stuff. He has published a book called Cancer is a Metabolic Disease, and you can also see his lectures on YouTube. Well, the point is that I was making before we got off onto this cancer subject was that when voltage drops, a cascade of things begins to happen that leads us into chronic disease, one of which is you can't make new cells, and in addition, you start having things go wrong because you lower your oxygen, you lower your ability to make ATP, which lowers intracellular voltage. You have bugs that wake up and start causing you grief. And by the way, those bugs that are putting out those toxins can get in your bloodstream and go all over your body, damaging it. And it's my view that that's when people say you have an autoimmune disease. The body isn't attacking itself. It's these digestive enzymes coming from these cell wall deficient organisms that are going around damaging things, not the body itself. So I don't believe there is such a thing as an autoimmune disease. And so eventually as the voltage drops further and further, you end up with a malignancy. And so the whole range from tired to cancer is really controlled by voltage. So that's going to lead us into the subject of, okay, what causes what is the mechanism for voltage transfer in the body and what causes it to be low? So, more questions or keep going?
No, that's fine, but I have a couple of things to say. I'm just, as you're speaking, I'm thinking of a leaf on a tree. We see the fungus on the leaf, And can we equate the same thing with our bodies, that we have these bugs that are dormant because we have voltage, therefore they're inactive, but the moment we die, just like leaves, when the tree dies or the leaf falls, immediately it starts decaying because the fungus becomes alive. Is that the same? Am I on the right track with that?
Yep. You see, whenever you say the word fungus, most people go, yuck.
Fungus, yeah.
But the reality is that fungus plays a very important role on the planet. If it were not for fungus, we'd all be over our eyeballs in dead leaves and dead animals. Because the role of fungus on the planet is to take dead organic material and turn it back into dirt. So if you think of a leaf on a tree, it has fungal spores on it, but because the leaf has voltage in it, it has oxygen. And oxygen is the switch, or lack of oxygen is the switch, that causes fungus to wake up and turn organic material into dirt. So as long as the leaf is on the tree and the tree is healthy and the voltage is there, then the fungus is suppressed. But then when we hit autumn and the voltage begins to drop in the tree, getting ready for winter, the leaf falls off, the oxygen goes away, the fungus wakes up and turns the leaf back into dirt.
Ashes to ashes.
Yep. And so that dirt is actually, there's more to this story, because that dirt is actually a mixture of what's called humic acids and fulvic acids. One of the components of humic acid is fulvic acid. So fulvic acids are a strange mixture of organic materials that the chemists have a hard time really identifying. But it's important because fulvic is what controls the passage of nutrients through the cell membrane. So the leaf is turned into dirt, a seed comes along and is blown into the dirt, and then you get a little water on it. Fulvic is what opens up the membranes of the seed and allows the humic with all of its vitamins, minerals, amino acids to go into the seed, and it begins to grow. So it grows up into a plant, and then we pick that plant and eat it, and now we have humic and fulvic in us, which then controls our cell membranes. The problem is that the farmers use fungicides and kill the fungus, so when the leaf falls off the tree, it doesn't get converted into humic and fulvic, and therefore the dirt eventually runs out of humic and fulvic, and so nothing will grow. So the farmers use fertilizer to get the plant to grow, but since the fertilizer doesn't contain all the stuff anywhere near what humic and fulvic does, the plants that grow up are basically nutrient deficient. So when we eat those plants, we're nutrient deficient, and pretty soon we run out of humic and fulvic, and so our cells can't function normally because they don't have the fulvic to monitor what goes in and out of the cells. Fortunately, we have a few places around the planet where there have been organic materials that were wet long enough not to turn into coal, and those can be harvested or mined and turned into a nutrient that contains good, pure humic and fulvic, which we can use as a supplement. And that's the way the land critters do it. Now, the sea critters get their humic and fulvic from these small plants called marine phytoplankton. And, of course, that can be harvested as well as an alternative source for humic and fulvic. So that's the role of fungus. Now, if you think about our discussion of cancer, of course, as voltage drops and oxygen drops, microorganisms lose their cell membranes and become cell wall deficient. So you can't culture them. They don't cause fever. They don't cause your white blood count to go up. But they put out these toxins and are very aggressive. And eventually, as voltage finally changes polarity from minus 25 to plus 30, you end up with mycelial-formed fungus. And those fungus fungi then put out toxins that damage the mitochondria, and that's what seems to be what leads us to a state of malignancy.
I'm an advocate of alkaline water and raising pH, and I've received some hate mail, Dr. Tennant, from people saying that I'm wrong, that distilled water is the best. But isn't distilled water dead water?
It is. One of the interesting things that I learned about that many years ago is that I used to teach young residents how to do eye surgery. And so we would go down to the slaughterhouse and get pig eyes, and we would use those for the new surgeons to learn how to operate on an eyeball. Well, in order to keep the corneas clear so that you could see what you're doing once you enter the eye, we would have to continuously drop saline on the cornea to keep it moist. Well, one day while I was teaching, somebody, instead of giving us saline, gave us distilled water. And as we put a couple of drops of distilled water on the cornea, it immediately became opaque, because distilled water sucks all the minerals out of the cells. And so it was so visually stunning for me to watch how that worked. And of course, I was aware during my residency, actually, that someone who was operating inside an eyeball irrigated inside the eyeball with distilled water instead of saline, and the cornea was completely destroyed and had, you know, destroyed all of the cells to keep the cornea clear. And the patient ended up having to have a corneal transplant because of that mistake. So every time I think about somebody drinking distilled water, I can just see the cells on the lining of their gut turning opaque all the way down. There's some interesting stuff that's come out in the last year or so also about water. The expert about that is Jerry Pollack, who's a researcher up in Washington.
Oh, he's a friend. He's been on the show. Yes.
Oh, good. Well, you know then about Jerry's work and about
the fourth phase of water.
Yep. So very important to drink good water. There's another thing that people get confused about. We'll talk about this and then eventually get back onto the voltage stream. But people say, well, you shouldn't drink water with your meal because it dilutes stomach acid. Or they'll say, if you drink alkaline water, the stomach acid is just going to neutralize it, so you know, why bother? Well, that's not the way the system works. Whenever you put anything at all in the stomach, it tries to go to a pH of 2, which is somewhere in the neighborhood of minus 80 millivolts or so. And it accomplishes that by inserting molecules of hydrochloric acid into the stomach. But for every molecule of hydrochloric acid it injects into the stomach, it injects a molecule, a corresponding molecule of sodium bicarbonate into the bloodstream. And so as you begin to take, let's say you put water with a pH of 9 into your stomach, very alkaline water, then you have to make quite a few molecules of hydrochloric acid to get down to a pH of 2, which means you've put a whole bunch of alkaline sodium bicarbonate into the blood. Now, on the other hand, if you drink a Coca-Cola, which has a pH of 2.3 into the stomach, it takes very little hydrochloric acid to get you down to 2, which means you have very little sodium bicarbonate in the blood. So the alkalizing effect of drinking alkaline water is not from the water itself, but that the alkaline water causes you to put a whole bunch of sodium bicarbonate into your blood, and that's how you raise your voltage. Now, the second piece of the puzzle is that when the gastric contents go into the small intestine, you have to go to a pH of 8. And it accomplishes that by the pancreas injecting sodium bicarbonate into the small intestine, which simultaneously puts hydrochloric acid in the pancreas. Well, if you made a bunch of sodium bicarbonate when you were putting acid into the stomach, it's sitting there ready to neutralize the hydrochloric acid that's being made from the small intestine function. But if you didn't make that sodium bicarbonate, then all of that acid is there in your pancreas with nothing to neutralize it. So that's why alkaline water is a good thing to drink, is because of this sodium bicarbonate mechanism.
Did I explain that well enough? Oh, you certainly did. I'm so glad we're talking about this because this is critical. So if the body's primary source of amino acids is stomach acid, why do so many doctors prescribe or recommend antacids?
Well, the whole process tends to start with iodine and zinc deficiencies. So maybe as much as 90% of the population is deficient in iodine and about 80% is deficient in zinc. Well, why does that matter? Well, it matters because to make stomach acid requires vitamin B1, iodine, zinc, salt, and voltage. Okay, vitamin B1, iodine, zinc, salt, and voltage. So if you're deficient in iodine or zinc or salt or voltage or B1, then you don't make much stomach acid. Well, what happens is that when stomach acid hits the small intestine, it creates a current that goes up and causes the sphincter between the esophagus and the stomach to close. Again, that's an electrical current, an electrical switch. So if you have enough stomach acid, when you're digesting your foods and it gets into your small intestine, it goes up and shuts down that valve. Well, people who don't have enough stomach acid because they're deficient in iodine and zinc or salt, etc., then they don't have enough current to close that switch, and so they get gastric contents that go back up into the esophagus and give you indigestion, and you'll say, oh, I got indigestion. So the docs will say, well, you have too much stomach acid. Let's shut down your stomach acid so you won't have that problem anymore. Well, indeed, if you don't have any stomach acid, it shuts down that, it eliminates the symptom, but it creates a whole bunch of other problems because the human's designed to never, ever absorb proteins. You must only absorb amino acids. And the reason for that is that it's the only way the body can identify what proteins are you and what ones are not you. So just behind our breastbone, we have a gland called the thymus. And the thymus gland contains the database of all the proteins that are you. And when you make white blood cells, they go through the thymus and the database is downloaded into each cell. And then the cell goes around the bloodstream looking for proteins. And when it bumps into one, it checks to see if that protein's in the database. And if it is, it says, oh, you're me, have a nice day. And it goes on to the next one. And it finds the next one and says, wait a minute, you're not in my database. You must be a virus or a bacteria here to hurt me. And so the white cell calls in the immune troops. The immune troops make antibodies to attack that protein. And if it can't destroy it, then it stuffs it into a fat cell to try to protect you from it. So if you don't have stomach acid to break your proteins into amino acids, then as those proteins go downstream and get absorbed, you develop antibodies so you become allergic to every single food you eat. And so usually some 30 or 40 minutes after a meal, you have this mini flu because you've got this immune system attacking all of the proteins you just ate. And remember that even the carbohydrates that we think of as carbs, like a banana, a raspberry, or whatever, or grains, all have an identifying protein within them. So even things we think of as carbs have identifying proteins. And of course, the identifying protein for grains is called gluten. And so if gluten isn't broken into amino acids in your stomach and goes downstream, you become, guess what, gluten intolerant because you develop antibodies against gluten, all because you didn't have stomach acid.
It's interesting how I hear from people who have ulcers and they're told, oh, you need to take antacids. And I've heard other people say, no, take some apple cider vinegar and you'll feel so much better. What's your take on that?
Well, apple cider vinegar is a substitute for hydrochloric acid, pure and simple. It's acetic acid, of course, and so it will also break proteins into amino acids. Now, as far as stomach ulcers are concerned, you get a stomach ulcer when the voltage in your stomach is low enough to allow you to get H. pylori infection. You do not get infections when your voltage is normal. So if you drop your voltage in your stomach, then you can get the infection, and then that's a stomach ulcer. And of course, an ulcerated tissue is not happy when you pour acid on it, because it doesn't have the protection from the acid that would normally line the stomach. So it's not really an issue. You have to separate sort of the two concepts about the discomfort versus what caused it. And you see, the main reason that people get low voltage in the stomach is that they have an infected molar, upper molar or lower premolar. When those teeth get infection or decay underneath a crown or underneath a filling or, worst of all, a root canal, then that acts like a circuit breaker and shuts the voltage off in the stomach. And now the stomach, first of all, can't make stomach acid because it doesn't have the voltage to do it, and it can't protect itself from infection because the voltage is low.
This is so interesting. We keep learning more and more. But going back to the original question, what are the main mechanisms that control voltage in our bodies?
Well, the primary mechanism is thyroid hormone, but it's particular thyroid hormone, namely T3 and T2. T3 acts at the cell membrane, but also acts at the mitochondria, and T2 acts primarily in the mitochondria. And so people who don't have enough thyroid hormone then have low total body voltage. So every circuit that you measure will be low voltage. Or saying that another way, when we go measure the voltages in all of the various organs and find that they're all low, that's hypothyroidism till proven otherwise. Now, the reason that so much hypothyroidism is overlooked is multiple. First of all, the thyroid cascade begins in the hypothalamus of the brain. And the hypothalamus makes thyrotropin-releasing hormone, which tells the pituitary to release thyroid-stimulating hormone, which tells the thyroid gland to release T4, and then T4 has to be converted to the active form of T3, and the majority of that conversion occurs in the liver, but can occur in other tissues as well. And if you can't convert from T4 to T3, you end up making a fake hormone called reverse T3 that's like a key that fits in the keyhole but won't turn the tumbler. Now, if we start at the beginning of that scenario, the hypothalamus is under control of adrenaline. And if you don't have enough adrenaline, then your hypothalamus doesn't work correctly. Well, to make adrenaline requires the amino acid tyrosine plus vitamin C and vitamin B6. Well, what's our source of tyrosine? It's an amino acid, which means if you don't have stomach acid, you don't have tyrosine. You don't have tyrosine, you don't have the ability to make adrenaline, you don't have enough adrenaline, your hypothalamus doesn't work. And so not only do you not have the right feedback mechanism with thyrotropic releasing hormone, our temperature center is also in the hypothalamus, and so our body temperature is low. And because adrenaline controls our diastolic blood pressure, it will be low, etc. So the other problem is the TSH test. The TSH test was developed in the late 1960s, put in place by the NIH in 1971, and they said normal was 1 to 10. And docs were told to adjust thyroid doses until they could get the TSH between 1 and 10. Well, one of the problems was is that they only used 46 people to determine norms, and 46 people isn't really statistically significant. And so they soon found that they were having to cut thyroid doses in half just to get into that range, and people started feeling bad again. But they didn't, they just ignored the fact people felt bad. And about over time, they changed those norms. Eventually, what most labs put out now is 0.4 to 4.6. Well, even that's a problem because in 2003, the American Academy of Clinical Endocrinology said that the normal should be 0.5 to 3.0. And that same year, the Society for Clinical Chemistry said that it should be 0.5 to 2.0. So basically, if our labs are 10 years late updating their normals, so let's say you go to your doc and they do a TSH test and it comes back 4, the doctor will tell you that because that's between 0.4 and 4.6, that that's normal. Well, it's not normal. It's twice normal. So that's a problem. TSH test is also not reliable in people who are chronically sick, people who've had chemotherapy, and during pregnancy, etc. So that's a big problem. The other thing is that fluoride is a halogen, as is iodine. And T4 and T3 are basically tyrosine with iodines on them. But anytime you put a molecule of fluoride anywhere near a molecule of iodine, it'll push the iodine out of the way and take its place. So you end up with fluoridated hormones that don't work. So for all of these reasons, we end up with a lot of people who are really hypothyroid, but their docs keep telling them it's normal. Well, another problem is that we give most docs and the governmental agencies all encourage doctors to prescribe levothyroxine or Synthroid, which is pure T4. Well, again, if you can't convert to T3, it doesn't work. And so that's docs keep increasing T4, but it's still not being converted, and so patients don't get better. And as you increase the T4, you just make more and more reverse T3, which blocks up more of the receptors, which makes things worse. So there's a lot of confusion about thyroid disease out there. Well,
you touch on something very important here for a second, fluoridation. We see this in a lot of the water supply in many cities. And since we're talking about electron stealers, is fluoride an electron stealer?
Yeah, it's one of the worst ones that's on the whole periodic table. As a matter of fact, in 1936, both the Italians and the Germans gave fluoride to patients who had overactive thyroids. And that worked quite successfully as a treatment for that. And the amount of fluoride it took to make a hyperthyroid patient normal is the amount we put in our city water supply. So we are using an effective treatment for overactive thyroid for all of our normal people and thus making most of them hypothyroid. So one of the reasons that some estimates are that the American population is 80% or 90% hypothyroid is due to the fluoridation of our water. So it's nuts, but that we're trading prevention of a few cavities to make our entire population tired, dumb, and stupid.
And if that's the case, does fluoridation cause obesity?
Yeah, because one of the things that happens when you're hypothyroid is that you began to, your body makes a substance called mucin, which is a mucose polysaccharide or a high molecular weight sugar that gets, fills up our tissues, our muscles, et cetera. And so what we think is fat is really, we're just loaded with mucin. And and of course, when we are tired because we have low voltage, we don't exercise. And also, one of the things that we try to do in order to feel a little better is we want sugar and we want caffeine, which gives us a little bit of spark and helps get through the day. But the sugar, particularly the high fructose corn syrup that is in most of our sweet things, it selectively places fat around our organs and around our gut. So high fructose corn syrup is actually metabolized in the body exactly the same way as alcohol, except it doesn't have the sedative effects of alcohol, but otherwise it gives us the classical beer gut and causes all the problems associated with fat around our organs.
So if the, well, I guess a majority of the American population now is obese, are we going to give them gastric bypass surgery, or wouldn't it be simply better to take fluoride out of the water, the toothpaste, dental offices? Isn't this economics versus science?
Oh, absolutely. And of course, many of our problems are just that. Of course, another thing that leads to obesity is genetically modified foods. And of course, that's all about economics. You know, it would be so much better if we would stop poisoning our population and with our food, with our drinks, with our air, with putting mercury into teeth. You know, there's so much of what we do that is destroying our population, which is one of the reasons that the United States is one of the sickest populations in the world.